John Cassian is one of the most important monastic sources for the Christian West, because as a disciple of Evagrius Ponticus and someone who traveled widely in Egypt during the early monastic movement, he, when he moved back to the Christian West, settled in what is now France, in Gaul. He then, in later life, wrote in Latin about his earlier experiences and created the institutes and the conferences, very much like a kind of a rule for monks, a description of what monasticism was like, ideally in the desert monasteries of Egypt, and also a series of the teachings that he had received, a kind of a gathering together of the best of the wisdom of the desert fathers under whom he'd studied, primarily Evagrius Ponticus, although he never mentions him by name. And he bequeaths this as a tradition to the West, as we'll talk about in later portions of the course. His institutes and conferences are read throughout the Christian West, throughout the medieval period, right down up until modern times, and become a standard textbook of instruction in the spiritual life, a standard text that would be read by anybody involved in spiritual guidance and spiritual direction. He also provides in his writings various models of spiritual directors, of spiritual guides. But in this conference, the thing we're most interested in is his appropriation of models derived from Origen and Philo, adapted with an understanding of the Christian lifestyle, which he has obtained from his master Evagrius, creating a synthesis which would be used in the Christian West as a way of understanding the spiritual life, the spiritual journey, intriguingly the steps and stages of contemplative exegesis he describes will also become the basis for a model of, or are already to some extent being used as, a way of interpreting the spiritual journey, levels of purgation, of purification, of perceiving the creation around us, of appreciating God in the created order, the physical world, and then a level that looks beyond creation into God. Those are not only seen as being movements within the spiritual journey, but as ways of describing the overall themes of different times of one's spiritual life. All of that is contained in embryo, and in some cases explicated to some extent in Evagrius's and here in Cassian's model of the development of a model of biblical exegesis, a fourfold model, which becomes in the medieval West a way of understanding almost all literature. And his fourfold level of exegesis can still be found in literary interpretation today. Dante says that it's the way you are to understand his great description of heaven, hell, and purgatory, his great spiritual journey. And in the same way, later medieval and early Renaissance literature, such as Spenser's Faerie Queen, can easily be interpreted and is intended to be interpreted in the same way that the biblical text is here, with an appreciation of or a presumption that the text has these multiple levels of meaning and that they correspond to ways of viewing creation within the human heart. Let's look at Cassian's presentation. We're going to look rather briefly only at select sections of this conference, which is rather long, but I invite you to take a look at it later on your own as you have the opportunity. Notice that in chapter 1, he makes a distinction between practice, which he describes as what we would call asceticism, an awareness of the need for discovering one's own vices, changing one's forms of behavior, and searching after the virtues, and the theoretici or contemplative life. And if you drop down to the highlighted text in 1.3, he talks about practice as improvement of morals, purification from faults, and theoretici, or the contemplative life, as Philo would have had it, or Aristotle would have described it, which consists for him, for Cassian, in the contemplation of things divine, contemplatione divinarum rerum, and knowledge of most sacred thoughts. This is acquired by attention to the deeper meanings of the texts and scriptures. He describes in chapter 3, if you drop down, that the practice, the practical or ascetical life, consists in knowledge of the nature of faults, discovery of the order of virtues. It's believed that there is an ordering to the virtues, that one should try to practice them in a particular order. We might today say that one needs to discover one's specific and unique individual flaws so as to know which virtues need to be practiced in what order because of the nature of one's own particular weaknesses and fallenness. And that would be a contemporary application of an insight which Cashin himself offers here. If we drop down then to chapter 4, he talks about the fact that this practical life, the active life, the life of discovering vice and of seeking after virtue consists in a whole different variety of ways of life, of professions and interests. He uses the example of Elijah and of some desert fathers whom he has known. He points out that there are some who are specifically given over to service of others, care of the sick, almsgiving, or to teaching. And he talks about the need in chapter 5, if we go down a little further, to persevere in whatever profession God has called us to, whether this is teaching or ministry or exhortation, or to live a life of simplicity or carefulness. This is all for him the active life, the way of seeking after how to live out Christian virtue in its fullest form, and it's unique to the individual, and each individual is called to a specific aspect of this. People advance, he says, in many ways towards God in chapter 6. And then in chapter 7, he talks about an example of the virtue of chastity. In chapter 8, this is where he begins to talk about what we would call the spiritual levels, the contemplative meanings within the scriptures, and he describes three levels which become absolutely classical in the Western tradition, and he's taking these directly from Origen and from Evagrius. They are the tropological, or the moral sense, the allegorical, or the symbolical, often what we might be tempted to call the Christological sense, a sense of how the Lord is present in an unexpected way in created things, and an anagogical, or heavenly, or eschatological, transcending creation sense of the world, but especially of Scripture as well. Now notice he's not specifically defining this as a method of exegesis at this point. He's saying that our lives consist of practici and theoretici, of this active virtue-seeking dimension and this theoretici, this contemplative dimension, which has as its aspects moral, allegorical, and unanagogical dimensions. Now, he'll make this into a method of biblical exegesis, but it is much more for him. It is a way of beholding the whole of our spiritual lives, of understanding our aspirations and where we're going. So what we saw in Origen of an integration, or the hint of an integration between a method of biblical exegesis, the scriptures as the principal formator in our spiritual journey, and then uniting that with the vision of the journey itself as reflected in the act of interpreting the scriptures, but also having a much broader context where our approach to the scriptures gives us skills and tools that we can apply in our broader lives. That's more obviously here in Cashin, who is describing this tropological, allegorical, and anagogical aspect or dimension to the contemplative life, which all of us engage in, this contemplative dimension, this movement back and forth between spiritual activity and receptivity. And now he defines them, and you can begin to see that he's hinting more specifically at something exegetical. There is a historical dimension, he says, so although he's speaking of a threefold method, this threefold level is actually the three levels beneath the historical sense. There is the historical sense, which actually creates, of course, a fourfold sense. History is first, then allegory, he says, in section 8.2, which prefigures some form of mystery, and then anagogy, this heavenly sense, in which spiritual mysteries rise to still more sublime and sacred secrets of heaven. And also a moral, a tropological sense, that's the moral explanation that has to do with improvement of life, practical teaching. So we have now, in Cashin, a four-leveled understanding of the scriptures on the one hand, and of human existence on the other, of a literal, a historical, a surface, but an accurate, a created dimension to things which must be interpreted, must be understood, and then three spiritual senses, an anagogical, a heavenly sense, an allegorical, a symbolic or Christological sense, and a tropological or moral sense. If we drop down, because the rest of this chapter is explications of these different levels of these spiritual senses, and skip also past the whole of chapter 9, moving on to chapter 10, he talks about how to embrace this system of what he calls true knowledge. And here he offers an understanding of the spiritual journey that focuses more specifically on the project of what we would call Lectio Divina. He says in 10.2, give yourself over assiduously, or rather continuously, to sacred reading, until continual meditation, continua meditatio, fills your heart and fashions you, so to speak, after its own likeness, making of it, in a way, an ark of the testimony. So we become like the Ark of the Covenant. In engaging in Lectio Divina, in engaging in what he calls sacred reading, continuous meditation of the scriptures, a regular reflection upon, a holding within the heart of whatever text has touched the heart, we become remade in a way like the Ark of the Testimony. And remember Cyprian's vision, that insofar as we engage in this alternating rhythm of lectio and oratio, we become more clearly the temple that is adorned by God and properly enabled to be the place of the indwelling of the Spirit. Well, Cashin is using the image of the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Testimony. That's what we are. If we engage in this project of reflecting on the scriptures, we are transformed, we are made into something new. But notice again that for him, this fourfold method with its three levels of spiritual meaning is a method of biblical interpretation, but also a way of looking out at the world, understanding the whole of one's spiritual or contemplative project. Then in chapter 10.4, a little further down, wherefore the whole series of the Holy Scriptures should be diligently committed to memory and ceaselessly repeated. This is a monastic discipline, the regular recitation of biblical texts, both at the Liturgy of the Hours, of course, in the Psalms and in the readings, but also during work. There is a constant reflection on, repeating of the sacred text within us, which has, he says, a twofold effect. The one is, this takes up the attention of the mind, and our mind is less likely to wander into bad things. We are, he says, taken up in reading, we are preparing lessons, therefore we can't be held captive in snares of bad thoughts. It avoids us going into bad places, he says. And so the next and more important aspect is that the things that were reflected on, conned over, frequently repeated, which we didn't understand at one time, will, after a time, become things that we see more clearly. So a holding and repeating within the heart has the wonderful effect of allowing the innermost self to see more clearly. After holding and repeating, one discovers a perception of a deeper meaning within these things, which is part of the goal, part of the task of this biblical project on the one hand, but it can also be applied to other things as well. That is almost as much as we're going to look at. If we drop down to chapter 13, there's one more text that I'd like us to note. Just under the introduction, or the bar that highlights chapter 13, he says, there will be a speedy and effectual remedy that will arise if only you will transfer to the reading of and meditation upon the writings of the Spirit the same diligence and earnestness which you say you showed in those secular studies of yours. He's reminding us that the practice of what we would call Lectio Divina is simply the application to the scriptures of what is already being done with secular text. This taking in, memorizing, repeating the text is the way that ancient learning was done. Cashin is inviting the monks who are being informed by his texts to use in their relationship with the biblical text the same skills that they would have been taught in secular learning, to hold, to repeat, to memorize, to make a part of themselves the biblical text, so that they can not only understand, but perceive beneath the surface the deeper meanings and the purposes of God. And as we've said, this method, derived ultimately from secular learning, now applied to the scriptures, also becomes a way of understanding one's own spiritual project. So the Bible becomes a means of making spiritual progress because the approach we take in its regard, this three and fourfold method of interpretation, is also, as it were, inscribed within the nature of our own spiritual project. It's how we understand the way we are to move forward in God. We have these multiple levels of ways of interacting with the world. Our interaction with the scriptures teaches us how to do that more effectively and efficiently, and it gives us contemplative eyes, a capacity to look out and into the world around us. And we'll see Cashin describing this in more detail, giving a rather beautiful, rhapsodic description of how taking in a particular verse or a particular passage from the scriptures can be not only wonderfully consoling, but can be a way of opening one's eyes to the glory and the beauty of the world around us. We'll see that later when we look at Cashin in specific, when we look at his conferences 9 and 10 on the practice of monologistic prayer.